I have made an automated audio engineer, and I have fallen down the largest nerdy rabbit hole ever and even taken a brief detour into the world of medical imaging science.
What? I mean, I know what this is because I've seen it.
It's all you've spoken about for the past 2 months.
It is the single topic of conversation that we have had for a while. So, yes, I'm aware of what this is. But like, for those poor people out there who don't know what it is, what are you talking about?
Yeah, so when we went independent, we needed to take care of our own audio production. And some of the complaints we've received, you've kind of illustrated that we hadn't quite got a full handle on it. So I had a long-held belief that it should be possible to create an entirely automated audio processing chain that behaves like a professional audio engineer without any human involvement, and it should be operational by anyone without any audio engineering experience.
Complaints to Martin at wimpress.org from all you audio engineers out there who don't want to be replaced by a tiny shell script.
Oh, not a shell script. I think I have been working on this since November the 3rd. It is, without doubt, the most sophisticated bit of software I've ever created.
It is your opus, is it?
And I used to write analytical software for black box flight recorders. So, you know, this is some, you know, claim. So what I've created is an audio engineer in a box. And you heard me talk about FFmpeg Statigo, and that was the precursor to building this thing. So this utility is a Go client application, runs in the terminal. It has that embedded FFmpeg engine inside it. So it's a single binary, runs on Linux and Mac and all the architectures. And I started this project because I was thinking, well, how hard can this be? Like, you can obviously do this, right?
The evergreen question that the buzzing engineer says, yes. Well, how can it be?
Well, it turns out it is precisely 2 months of Sundays hard to do. It was all of my spare time since the beginning of November until quite recently. And the idea is very simple. You record your audio, you feed your audio into this thing, and coming out the other side is fully processed, EQ'd, cleaned up, broadcast-ready audio that you could use to, I don't know, play on the radio if you're that kind of person, or, you know, master a podcast, or maybe use it in audio in a YouTube video, something like that.
I'm pretty sure there are people who say, you can't do that. That's why audio engineers exist and they all pay for very expensive software. You can't just use Go and a bit of FFmpeg to turn the speech and various other audio that people create into something much better, right?
Yes, and I think that's a fair position to hold unless you do some extraordinary amount of research, which is what I did. And so I think it can be done because, in fact, I think we've used this software now for the last two podcasts prior to this one. And it has a four-pass architecture. And the first thing it does is analyze the source audio. And I'll get into a bit more detail about what that does. And then it applies some processing. And then it takes some measurements again. And then it does the last step of bringing everything up to a broadcast level, which is the normalization step. When I was researching how to do this, because I was thinking, oh, well, we can figure out like where the noise floor is and where the peaks of the speech are. We should be able to sort of do something. But whilst I was researching this, I found out that there's this concept of spectral metrics, which is a group of 13 audio measurements that precisely characterize a voice profile. So these 13 things tell you things like whether it's dark or warm, where the main vocal energy is, where the frequency roll-off is, where the bass tone is, whether it's muddy, you know, a whole bunch of things, like how dynamic the voice is. So you can use these metrics, and they all have a very specific meaning, and they're a mixture of logarithmic and linear and, you know, curves and things, but the numbers mean specific things. I mean, I don't fully understand it, but I understood enough to adapt this. And the whole point is that if you take those measurements of a voice profile, you can then tune the audio processing to be specific to that voice profile. So for in our case, it informs how it does the low end roll off to clean up all of the sort of the muddy base area, which it does for all three of us. But when I was testing recordings of my wife and daughter, it moves those frequencies further up the frequency range because it wants to preserve more of that energy in their voices to preserve the character of their voices and what have you.
So you run this thing separately on each audio file. So each presenter gets their own audio file and you run each one of those through this tool. What's it called?
It's called Jive Talking.
Of course it is. And what you get out is like what? When you've run this and there's like all kinds of processing done, you get another audio file out or you just get a report or what do you get out of it?
You get two things. You do get a FLAC audio file come out the other side, which is the fully processed audio, and it has a --- logs option. And if you turn that on, you get a very detailed report of all of the measurements that were made, what that actually means. And it tells you what the measurements were before the processing happened, partway through the processing, and at the very end after everything's been normalized. And then you can use those numbers to actually tell, for example, have I improved the quality of the audio or have I damaged the vocals in some way? So whilst I was figuring out how to tune this thing, you can do things that, you know, maybe take too much bass tone out of Mark's voice and then his voice sounds very thin and crackly and you don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can use these numbers without having to listen to the audio because sometimes we can't hear, you know, all of the things that are done, but the numbers don't lie. It's an objective assessment of what has happened.
While you're in the process of this, at one point you started showing us like manuals and circuit diagrams of some old bits of hardware. And what was all that about? Have you been like modeling processing tools of yore?
Yes, this was exactly where I started. My initial thought was in the pre-DSP era, there was audio hardware that was analog that could clean up audio.
Yeah.
That could compress audio, that could do limiting, and it could do it live, in line on radio stations. So I thought that's going to be quite simple algorithms. So what I've done is I went off and researched what were all of the best in breed pre-DSP era audio hardware, how did they work, and then I have reverse engineered their behavior in the FFmpeg filters. So I have recreated an LA-2A optical compressor and a Dorma DS-201 noise gate.
Ah, the Dorma.
And a UI-1176 peak limiter, and been inspired by Ray Dolby's SR noise reduction circuitry from 1982, which he published white papers about. So some of the main core of the audio processing is based on the sort of foundational principles of analog stuff. But then there's all of this new digital piece to, you know, get the audio metrics. So one of the things we do when we record the podcast, which the listeners never hear, is we intentionally record 15 seconds of silence.
Well, yes, it would be very difficult for the listeners to hear that, 15 seconds of silence that we put at the beginning of the show. Well spotted.
But it's kind of a misnomer because we're not recording silence. We're actually recording the room tone. And when you load our audio into Audacity to edit it, we have some manual tools in Audacity to say, look, learn the noise profile, the room noise profile from this 15 seconds segment. And of course, I didn't want to have to manually do that. So I've written a simple heuristic that goes and looks for our intentionally recorded silence for each of our voices. And then it uses that segment and it refines it down to the 10 second golden subsample. And it uses that as the profile for how to identify the noise floor. And then similarly, it looks for our speech. And it looks for 30-second or longer segments of speech, and it elects one of those as our speech candidate, and it takes all of those vocal measurements for our voices. So it uses these two different profiles, one for when we're removing noise, and another one for when it's adapting the EQ and things on our voices. And then that's how these re-implementations of these classic vintage audio processors are tuned based on these measurements that have been taken.
And are there like knobs to twiddle, and are there lights and flashing and cables to pull out in this software, or is it all just you just run it, fire and forget, and like that's it?
Yeah, you literally just run it. You run it and say, this is the audio file I want to be processed, and it runs. And it's quite nice. It's the way I've done the other two tools, Jive Drop and Jive Fire. So it actually displays a live VU meter and what have you as it's, you know, processing this. So you can
see a multicolor
see it.
VU, like.
Yeah, and right. It's got a peak level marker and all of that sort of thing. But no, I wanted it to have no buttons or bells or whistles or anything. You just feed it in. So anyone could use this. You don't need to know anything about audio. It's a black box. You feed audio in and you get decent quality audio out the other side.
So the goal of this is to streamline our process, as you said at the start, and the idea is that you run each of our audio files through this and you get a better audio out, but there's still some stuff to do, like cutting out coughs and
right.
Where we misspeak, or like the bit at the beginning where we're just like chatting and stuff like that. So there's still a bit of work to do that's not fully automated, right?
Yeah, so this is less about automation and more about consistency, because we each take it in turns to do the podcast production now. We kind of understood what we were supposed to be doing in Audacity with the EQing tools, but we didn't know precisely what or why we were doing those things. So what this does is it takes all of that guesswork.
Speak for yourself, sir. I knew exactly what buttons I was pressing. I was following a script that Tony Whitmore wrote many years ago.
Well, indeed, you know, we were doing sort of the right thing. But now what's happening is each of our voices are getting the appropriate amount of treatment. And one of the things I read in Ray Dolby's white paper is he had this principle of least treatment. And the way that the Dolby equipment worked back then is they did the least amount of processing possible. And I really sort of leaned into that. So the whole point of this is it doesn't do anything if it doesn't need to, or it does the very least amount of processing possible to preserve as much sort of natural vocal dynamics and character of the original audio as possible.
So is this a hardwired, you know, like one of your tools has like our artwork in it and is like very much like if you download the binary, you're basically making our podcast. Whereas this one... is it like hardwired to our voice profiles or something, or can anyone who's thinking of making some audio, not necessarily a podcast, for any reason, can they just like download the binary or download the source and build it and then run this and hopefully get better audio out the other side?
Yes. Although it has been extensively tested on our audio for, I don't know, about 8 or 9 episodes. I have had family members record audio samples and fed that through to make sure that it doesn't skew too much towards our sort of baritone voices. So, you know, it does adapt to children's voices and female voices and maybe someone with a higher register and things like that.
What's left to do? Is it done? Is it finished?
It is kind of done. I think the hardest thing that was done was the noise removal. And this is where I went off into an excursion around medical imagery, because I couldn't get the noise removal to work. I tried all of these techniques I'd read about in all of these vintage things, and I just couldn't get it to work well. And in fact, we had some chaos with our audio in this period as well. So we were actually struggling.
Some chaos.
I think, you know.
We needn't trouble the listener with that.
No, we don't.
Details.
We had some entropy in our production processes. And I couldn't find a way for the noise reduction or removal to adapt to the different characteristics. But I found that there was this mechanism used in medical science for microscopists and MRI images to remove noise from medical images, but preserving all of the detail. And somebody has adapted that algorithm to audio. And This was the FFmpeg filter that I wanted FFmpeg 8 for. And when I used this, it solved all of the problems with the noise removal. It is not just good, it is great. And I even downloaded old copies of the manuals of Isotope RX, which is a very expensive noise removal piece of software, you know, professional audio software, and read about how it works. And they don't give away all the secrets, but I could tell it was kind of the same sort of thing. Anyway, with that added, this it's like non-local means or something, non-local mean algorithm. With that added, it really cleaned up the audio. And then I was able to use this classic audio reduction technique from Dolby on top to really clean up the audio. So that was sort of the big breakthrough. And that's what made it all possible. As to where it is now, it's sort of finished. You know, we have used it for a few episodes, but I think I might clean up the code a little bit and maybe sort of tweak it at the edges a little bit. I mean, if I had enough time, I'd rewrite the whole thing actually using DSPs, but I haven't got time for that.
I think you'll find the listeners will tell us how well or badly this thing works, especially after this very episode where you're extolling the virtues of this tool and using it using your voice. So I think that's going to be the measure of this.
I've written a remote for my Roku.
A remote control?
Well, sort of. So you could, my Roku came with a remote control, I should say. We lost it. We bought a new one. You can also get a remote control app on your phone. And the way that that works, it turns out, is through basically a local web service running on the Roku device to press the buttons that, you know, send button presses to the TV. Now, the reason I got interested in this was because I've mentioned before, I now have my Jellyfin server, which stores my video, turned off most of the time. And when you launch the Jellyfin app on my TV, it sends a request to the server, which goes through a reverse proxy. And if the server's not on, it sends a wake-on LAN request to the server to turn it on. And that's part of my you know, family acceptance experience for this setup, that they shouldn't have to go into the garage and poke a server when my daughter wants to watch a Polly Pocket video.
I think it's actually a lesson that they need to learn. Like, you know, my son's just bought his first car and it wasn't a great one. So, you know, it's one of those things you have to learn. I think they should learn that, you know, you've got to have SSH available and you need to know, have your SSH keys about your person, you know.
Yes.
All of this. It's great lessons, life lessons. You're making it too easy for them, Mark, I think.
Yeah. This current setup basically works, right? You press a button on the TV to launch the app, and after an amount of time, you can then connect to the server. The trouble is, there isn't any feedback to anyone except me that the server is booting and has booted. So you basically have to just keep on clicking on and off the app and hoping that by this point, the server is then available, at which point it will automatically connect and show you what's available. So I went looking for a way of telling the TV that the server had finished booting. And this is when I found this remote control protocol. So this, they call it ECP, I think, External Control Protocol, which is, it's just a REST web service. And by default, if you're on the local network, you can just send a curl request to say key press home, key press up, key press one, or whatever. And it'll be like you're pressing a button on the remote.
And is this protocol specific to Roku, or is this sort of an industry standard remote control protocol?
To my knowledge, it's a Roku specific thing. Some of the stuff, which I'll talk about in a minute, is very much specific to what's going on the Roku. So I don't know, maybe some of the remote control stuff is similar to what you have elsewhere. But this is obviously how the remote control app works, by sending these key press commands, which is good, but it doesn't really do enough, because if it can't see what's on screen, it can go home and close the app, but it can't then launch it again very effectively if it doesn't know what's there. So I had a bit of a poke around and found that there's some extra functions where you can query what's going on at the moment. The things I didn't want it to do were to close the app if you weren't, like if the server had come on for some other reason and you were watching, say, Netflix. I didn't want it to say, oh, the server's booted now, I'm going to launch Jellyfin for you, because that isn't necessarily what you want.
Right.
So what I've had it do is it calls a query on the media player endpoint, which will tell you what, well, basically what's being displayed at the moment. And if then, if that's the Jellyfin app, it will close the Jellyfin app and then launch it again. And so what that means is you press the button on the telly to launch the Jellyfin app, it sends off its wake on LAN request, the server boots up, the server then says to the telly, right, if you're running Jellyfin, close Jellyfin and open it again. And that happens on the telly and it connects to the server and you've got your videos.
I like that. That's fairly straightforward. That's fairly simple. And family proof, right?
Yeah.
Is family proof this?
No one has to know what's going on. You just have to know, you press it and you wait and the right thing will happen. You don't have to know or do anything else. Because what I've had in the past is they press the button, it's not working. And like looking at my phone, waiting for the notify ping to say, oh, the server's on now. And then I say, okay, try again now. Oh, it's still not there. Oh, maybe it's still just starting up. Yeah, but now it's no, literally you press it, it will do the right thing. Leave it alone. Don't need to talk to me. Don't need to talk to anyone else.
Could you not like make the TV say something out loud? The Roku box is now running or something.
This was my initial thought. It's like, surely there's some way of getting it to, because I know when I've done sort of stuff like this with Kodi in the past, you can tell Kodi display a notification. I thought, oh, there must be some way of like having something appear on screen in the Roku, but there isn't. But you can tell it to like kill the app and tell it which app to launch. It's not that easy to work out because you've got to do these queries to find the app ID. You can't just say launch Jellyfin. You have to say launch app 15968.
Are you using an actual Roku box, one of the little like things the size of an Apple TV, or are you using a TV that's got the Roku functionality built into it?
In this case, this is on a Roku TV.
Okay. And there's no way to tell the TV operating system to send a notification?
The TV operating system is Roku.
Oh.
Yeah, the whole thing is Roku. When you turn it on, there's no like launch the Roku app and then it gives you all the stuff. It's just Roku, like boot to Roku or something. Yes. the other cool thing I found out was doing this was some of the querying endpoints I used. You had to be in developer mode to access them. You can access all the like remote control functions just straight out of the box. But if you want to query like which app's running, you have to put it in developer mode. And the way you do that is you enter a cheat code on your remote control.
Right. Is it the Konami code?
I don't think it's exactly the same, but it's got the home button in as well. There's lots of up, right. Down, left, right, home. And then it like pops up and says, oh, accept these terms and conditions. And that gives you access to all this stuff. It also gives you another web interface to load your own apps on. So if you were developing apps, it actually gives you a web interface that's running on the telly that you can then upload your own apps to.
Yeah, this is what I used when I made the Roku app for the old podcast back in the day.
Excellent.
Could you patch Jellyfin, given that's open source, such that it polls the back-end server and then refreshes itself when it comes up?
What, as in the Roku app, the Roku Jellyfin app?
Yeah.
Oh, so I make myself a customized version of the Jellyfin app just for my specific setup. I could.
Jellyfin is open source. You could contribute to the upstream project and have it like, I can't imagine you're the only person on the planet with a media server that's turned off sometimes. I feel like this is a feature that Jellyfin could grow. Maybe it already has. Maybe there's a plugin or something that someone's done. Yeah. I don't know.
But yes, I feel like this is now like a bit of a Heath Robinson bag of bits. So I've got the bits on my server. I've got the bits on my other server. I've got the PHP script. I've got the reverse proxy thing. I think somehow I need to bundle these all together and put them on GitHub so that if anyone else wants to do
it. Rotating light on top of the TV to let you know when it's up. Like, yeah, that would be good. I recently became a security blogger somewhat accidentally. I didn't intend to, but... my blog got shared among security professionals in that kind of ecosystem, which was a bit weird. Yeah.
Does your vulnerability have a snappy domain name and logo combination?
No, sadly not, because I'm not that important and I didn't make a big discovery. It turns out all I did was find something that other people knew was already there, but I publicized it a little bit more. You may remember in a previous episode, I talked about the ChainGuard Vibe Olympics, which was a coding contest that, if you recall, I can't win because my boss was one of the judges. And I made this Moji Nav navigation app for walking around cities and finding like burger joints, coffee and parks and so on. And that got me through to round two. And in round
Good
two.
Good Lord.
I know.
What were the other entries?
I couldn't possibly comment, but not as good as mine, I think, in my humble opinion. The second round was to develop a security tool, but it was kind of vague as to what it had to do. And I thought, this is my time to shine, despite still not being able to win this thing. I would like to get through to round two and then do something worthwhile. And so I built a thing that brings together a couple of things that I thought were interesting, which is the Snap packages, of which I maintain like 50 or so in the Snap store. But also, my previous employer, Anchor, has a tool for finding vulnerabilities in software packages and containers. And I thought, I could marry these two things together and provide a kind of dashboard that shows all the vulnerabilities or potential vulnerabilities that there are in the packages that are published in the Snap store, because I don't think anyone had done that yet. I know people do scans of like popular places like NPM, like node packages, JavaScript node packages, mm-hmm. and PyPy and stuff like that. I don't think anyone had actually done a scan of the Snap store. And while I was at Anchor last year, we worked with Canonical to add support for scanning Snap packages, which are compressed like loopback file systems that contain like binaries and other assets. And so the tools at Anchor, put together with my knowledge of the Snap store, I thought this is a thing mm-hmm. that needs to be made, right? So what it does, the thing that I built, is it presents a web UI in which you could just type in the name of a snap and it will go and get that snap from the Snap store and scan it. And what it does is generate an SBOM, a software bill of materials, which is just a document. It's mm-hmm. usually a JSON file, but it could be XML. And that is basically an itemized list of everything that's in the package. Now, I'm pointing it at a snap, but you can equally point them at devs or a directory or a container or a Git repo. It's the tools SIFT. SIFT is the tool, S-Y-F-T, that's made by Anchor. It's very flexible. And so that's why I wanted to use it. And I knew it supported Snap. So point it at the snap, and then my service stores that SBOM, which is just a JSON document, stores that, and then it runs another tool from Anchor called Gripe. And Gripe is the vulnerability scanner, and it gets a vulnerability database that's updated every day. It's freely downloadable, and that's produced by Anchor. And it then scans the SBOM to see what was in the snap and see if there are any known vulnerabilities for the packages for mm-hmm. whatever versions that are found. And so that's really all it does. It just takes the name of a snap, goes and gets the snap from the Snap store, scans it with SIFT to generate an SBOM, hands that SBOM to Gripe. Gripe then looks for vulnerabilities, and then it produces a report on the web page that you can see that highlights any critical, high, medium, low, or ignored, or like vulnerabilities that are not going to be fixed, or negligible, I think is the lowest one, but also known exploited vulnerabilities. So these are vulnerabilities that have exploits out in the wild.
Right.
Now, it's not saying that there are problems with these snaps. It's not saying that these snaps have vulnerabilities and you are vulnerable to all these things. It's an extra piece of information that the publisher of the snap can look at to help them decide if there's anything that needs updating or if there's anything that needs mitigating, like, you know, blocking access to certain things to mitigate that CVE, that vulnerability. But it's also useful information for users of snaps to be able to see, oh, this snap hasn't been updated for a while, and look, it has lots of vulnerabilities. And so that's really what I wanted, is to present data that informs publishers and users on the state of the snaps in the store. And that's what it turned into, is a way to do that. And I got that finished within the timeline for round two of the contest, and I published it. And sadly, I didn't get through to round three, which was the final. Oh, dear. Despite it being an excellent tool that actually has some longevity beyond this silly contest that I took part in. And one of the things that I noticed, I was reminded that there are snaps that get published in the store that not only ones that have security vulnerabilities, but there are actually some that contain malware, intentionally contain malware.
Right.
And I've blogged about this before, like over the last 2 years, and I've analyzed some of the snaps and discovered they're still doing it. The people who were putting dodgy crypto malware in the store are still doing it, and they purport to be some wallet application, but they're not. They're just taking some credentials from the user who thinks it's a legit application, mm-hmm. and it then uses those credentials to empty that person's wallet. It drains their crypto wallet and then says, oh, I couldn't connect, and leaves the user thinking everything's fine. And then they find out very shortly afterwards that their crypto wallet has been drained and they feel sad. And so I wrote a blog post about this. I'd been like analyzing these snaps for a while, and someone else was doing this. We were working together on this. Daniel, who's in the Linux Matters Telegram group and is active in the Ubuntu community and has been doing some analysis as well. And we were sharing some information back and forth. And he's a bit quieter about these things than I am. And I was like, right, I'm going to write a blog post about this. And so I wrote a blog, and it kind of did the rounds, appeared on OMG Ubuntu and a bunch of other security blogs and LinkedIn and all kinds of places, because what it was identifying is ways in which the bad people are exploiting some of the gaps in the Snap Store.
So with your sift and gripe analysis, are there things that those tools pick up? Like, you can see in the SBOM there's a certain thing in a snap. Does that give you a clue that that snap might be malware? Or does it have to be like a manual analysis of, oh, that one's just come in, it looks like it's got a dodgy name, I'll go and unpack it and see what's in it?
Both. So you can, every file that's inside the snap is fingerprinted, basically, and listed in the SBOM. Mm-hmm. And so you could just grep all the SBOMs, effectively, and see which ones have got that file in. And a lot of the malware authors are lazy and reuse the same code. And yeah. So there will be files in there that are the same. And so if you find one that has that file in and you find another one, it's almost certainly all malware as well. I didn't do it that way. I was, like you say, spotting names and patterns. So I started looking for things where there are certain words like ledger in the name. Now, the Snap Store actually also looks for some of those words, and the malware authors have figured that out. And so they started putting non-Latin characters, like Cyrillic characters that look like the letter D and G and L in the word ledger, to get past that. The other thing that the Snap Store do is, as far as I can tell, they don't allow you to publish something dodgy on your first revision. Like, so if your first revision of your snap is, this is a crypto app, then it raises like the spidey senses and you don't get in. But what they can do is put a Hello World app in there, and then the second they get in the store, put revision 2 in, which has no vetting, and revision 2 has the malware. And so what I would often see is revision 1 was Hello World, and then immediately after, or the next day, revision 2 of the same thing suddenly became a crypto app. It was so obvious. It really was.
Yeah, the Moodle plugins database has a similar issue in that you have to have your app manually reviewed, your plugin manually reviewed, before it will be put in the database. But then you can publish future revisions without the same level of review. And while this hasn't led to the same sort of thing in the past, fortunately, it's like, it's a known thing that, you know, it's, you can't, there's not enough bandwidth of people to have that same level of scrutiny on every version that's published.
And I get the, you know, the human resource required to do this. There are currently around 7,084, or thereabouts, snaps in the store. The last time I looked, like last week. And that's not a lot. And so, yeah, you could actually have a human review. But I don't think, honestly, I don't think Canonical want to pay a human to do this. They want to build something for when it's got a million snaps in the store. Even though it doesn't have a million apps in the store, there's 7,000. And many of those 7,000 are not changing. They were published years ago and they haven't had updates. So actually the window that you need to scan is very small. And if me looking at one snap a day can find them, or sometimes five snaps a day and can find them, I think probably Canonical could put a little bit more investment in this. And in fact, I have had feedback that the blog post was raised internally at Canonical, the VP level, and they are aware that there are shortcomings and things they need to do. So, like, I'm not, the whole purpose of this wasn't to berate Canonical. It was to raise awareness of a thing. Mm-hmm. I publish snaps in the store. I want this thing to succeed. I want, you know, people to be able to get secure software quickly and easily and get their updates automatically and reliably, however that happens. And so I'm glad that they've seen it and there, you know, we'll think about doing something about that, hopefully.
Didn't you find another sort of classic supply chain attack as well that was being conducted?
Yeah, so the blog post mainly came out of the fact that I noticed that there were some snaps that had no longer got updates that were genuine snaps. And what had happened is the publisher had gone out of business, or the project had been abandoned for whatever reason. You know, legitimately, you know, there's no desire to continue maintaining the thing, whatever it is. But the problem is they let their domain expire. And the bad guys came along and found snaps that were published in the store whose domains had expired. And they picked up those domains and registered the domains, figured out the account under which these snaps were published, and then published dodgy apps over the top of the legitimate apps. And so that makes it such that people who had a legitimate application, could be an app or a game previously installed, under the covers via automatic update, they suddenly have this Ledger or whatever wallet app installed, right, that will steal their stuff. Now, some people have said, well, I would notice if an icon... No, you wouldn't. Like, an icon has disappeared from your menu and a new icon has appeared in your menu. A lot of people would not notice that. And they would go, oh, what's this? Oh, it's a Ledger thing. Oh, I've got a Ledger wallet. Click, try and log in. All their wallets drained, right? And that's what the blog post was mostly about, is this new attack vector that I don't think Canonical had considered and hadn't protected against. Like, there should be alerts when a domain expires that has something published in the store, and you should block updates, because it can't possibly be a legit update if a domain has expired from a vendor who's published something in the store sometime in the past. And they may have to go through a new review process. I don't know if they're going to do anything about that or have some alerting that detects that kind of thing. And I certainly had suggestions from people who said, you should add a thing to the snap scope, which is the thing I made for the contest, which highlights, like, this application is published from a domain which has changed hands. It might not have expired. Someone may have picked it up at the right moment, and it's just changed hands. That's all that needs to happen for that attack. I think it was worthwhile doing. And again, I only mean, like, good things to come out of this.